And we're going to go right to the discourse with Brother Wesley Kramer on Haggai. Haggai.
Thank you, Brother Jordan and Brother Dan and friends, and a collective good morning to each of you. It's a delight to be with you, and it indeed has been a splendid weekend, a feast of fat things, as has already been mentioned. Our topic for this session is the prophet Haggai. We'll be trying to look at some fundamental questions, and again, our endeavor will be to do an overview of this relatively short prophecy. This is not quite as short as Jonah, but it is a short prophecy. Our first question, of course, deals with the timing. Try to get the time frame in mind. We've appreciated the endeavors to do that so far this weekend. We understand that this prophecy was given approximately 86 years after Nebuchadnezzar completely dethroned Zedekiah and the 70 years desolation began. So it was approximately 86 years after the dethronement of Zedekiah. Obviously, that would compute or translate to being roughly 16 years after Cyrus's decree, allowing the Israelites, those who were interested, the faithful remnant, as it were, to return from Babylon, to go back to Jerusalem to fulfill the decree of King Cyrus to rebuild, to begin rebuilding process of the temple. Now, Haggai gives us a touchstone of the time frame here in verse 1. Haggai tells us in chapter 1, verse 1, that he prophesied during the second year of King Darius. Who and when was King Darius? King Darius, at this point in time, again, we'll try to give you the global flavor here, was probably the single most powerful individual in the world at this point in time. Darius is the third king of the Second Universal Empire. The Second Universal Empire was in force, was in vogue, was controlling the world at this point in time. We understand, we recall that Second Universal Empire as being the Medo-Persian Empire. We have this empire referenced in a couple places in Scripture. First of all, you recall in Daniel, the second chapter, we have the metallic image, Nebuchadnezzar's dream. This particular part of the image was not the head, but it was the arms and the breast made of silver. We also have a reference to the seventh chapter of Daniel, to the bear. In chapter 7, verse 5, we recall that the bear had three ribs between its teeth. The bear represents the Medo-Persian Empire. We may touch on what the three ribs are, at least maybe one or two of them as we go along, but that may be an interesting fellowship question. What does the three ribs in the bear's teeth in Daniel 7:5, what does that represent? Okay, so in any event, this gives us some touchstone with our time frame. This is the period during which Haggai was prophesying, during the reign of the Second Universal Empire, and particularly during the administration of King Darius, the third king of that particular empire. Who were Haggai's contemporaries? Who was on the scene when he was on the scene? Well, we'll have a much larger discussion after the lunch hour, but Zechariah was a contemporary with Haggai. Both of them prophesied in the second year of King Darius. And we find a number of verses in Haggai and Zechariah and also in Ezra that teach us that they were both prophesying during the second year of King Darius. Another of the contemporaries, while not a prophet, was a leader. And actually it was probably one of the most prominent leaders, if not the most prominent leader of Israel, was Governor Zerubbabel. He would have been a contemporary of the prophet Haggai. As you recall, he was the governor appointed by King Cyrus to lead the contingent of faithful Israelites, that faithful remnant, as it were, from Babylon back to Jerusalem to begin rebuilding the rebuilding work. Another contemporary, a third contemporary of Haggai's, would have been the prophet Daniel. You know, Daniel has a long span. He has a long history. Daniel of course, lived through the entire 70-year period of desolation. Daniel's unique. Daniel gives us a wonderful perspective because Daniel was born about 15 years prior to the beginning of the 70 years desolation. So he would have been about 15 years old at the time that Zedekiah was overthrown. He lived all the way through the 70 years of desolation in Babylon. And then he lived approximately 15 years after the return of King Cyrus and the faithful contingent. So Daniel had a long history. So there's a number of others who are contemporary with him. But anyway, Daniel would have been one of the contemporaries, partially contemporary, with the prophet Haggai. Well, our next question is, what was the immediate reason that the Lord sent Haggai to deliver this prophecy? What's the background? What was the lead-in, the lead-up to this particular prophecy? Well, as we've already mentioned, when King Cyrus issued his decree in 536 B.C., there were approximately 50,000 Israelites. Now, there was many more than 50,000 in Babylon at this point, but it was only that faithful remnant, only those who had a desire to return to Jerusalem to begin working on the rebuilding of the temple. So it's roughly 50,000 that returned. Upon their arrival, the eyes of these 50,000 faithful ones met with devastation. Can you imagine? The buildings had been burned to the ground by Nebuchadnezzar. The temple was destroyed. There were trees growing in the streets. The infrastructure lay in rubble. The sight was devastation. That's what they saw. But you know, the zealous construction crew didn't let that stop them. They went right to work. They knew what they had to do. They knew what they came to do and what their heart's desire was. And so Governor Zerubbabel broke this contingent of approximately 50,000 into work teams. And the first thing that they did was to reestablish their living infrastructure. They had housing units that needed to be quickly built, barracks, as it were, to house the workers, had to reconstruct the sewer systems, the water systems, and the various other parts of the infrastructure had to be rebuilt. And all this was done relatively quickly, within a very short period of time. But that was not all. It was not just a matter of reestablishing the physical infrastructure, but they also reestablished the spiritual infrastructure back in the land. Because it was not only Zerubbabel, their civil leader, that returned, but it was also Joshua. Joshua was the high priest at this point in time. And so, under their high priest, they also reestablished their religious ceremonies according to the law of Moses. Again, these were the faithful ones. This was not the ones who were wayward. These were the faithful contingent. They were interested in discerning and doing the will of the Lord. So they reestablished their religious services according to the law of Moses. Well, as soon as the temple builders got the infrastructure under control, very quickly after their return, they turned their attention to the main work for which they had returned. And, of course, one of the things that they needed was building materials. So we read, and again, a lot of this background information, by the way, comes from the book of Ezra. Ezra is more of a historical account. We're past the period of the period of time where the books of Kings and Chronicles will help us. So now we look for our historical information relative to this time frame. We look back into the book of Ezra, principally. And we learn there that one of the first things that the officials did after reconstituting and reconstructing their infrastructure was to go to Tyre and to go to Sidon and make contracts, enter into contracts with suppliers to obtain materials. And principally, the material that they obtained was cedar wood. The builders then went to work on preparing the site. You know, before you construct the building, the first thing you need to do, of course, is your site preparation. So the builders first went to work on doing their site preparation on Mount Moriah. Masons and carpenters were then dispatched to the scene to begin their work. Now, during this period of time, the builders were surrounded by unfriendly neighbors, neighbors that were not particularly friendly toward them. But you know that the work crew wasn't intimidated by them. There was some fear that these neighbors were not of the same religious faith as the Israelites who had returned, and apparently put them in some sense of apprehension. But the construction crew nevertheless went on. They overcame that fear, that apprehension of their neighbors, and kept the work going zealously. It was about 6 years after the return under King Cyrus, roughly 530 B.C., that the temple foundations were completed. And, of course, this led to a huge celebration. This was a major milestone that the construction workers had achieved in completing the temple foundation. But then we find, as we read through our account, a serious turn of events occurs. The work on the temple project, beginning in about 530 B.C., came to a halt, or nearly came to a halt. For all practical purposes, it ceased. The returned temple builders, they lost their zeal. They lost their determination. They gave up doing the Lord's work. Why? Why did they give up? Why did they cease the work? We understand that there were two reasons. One was an external reason. Secondly, was an internal reason. Now, by external reason, we're talking about their neighbors, their environment, those who were around them. That was one of the reasons that they ceased doing the Lord's work. There were two sources of external resistance that the Israelites faced. The first source was the same source as we mentioned earlier, which was the Israelites' immediate neighbors. Later, Jesus called these the Samaritans, and so we're going to call them the Samaritans. I'm not sure I don't think they were called the Samaritans at this point, but that's essentially who we're talking about, those who dwelt in Samaria. Now, the Samaritans, as we read through our account, approached Zerubbabel, and they said, you know, we've heard about this project that you're working on, this construction project, and we'd like to be a part of it. We'd like to join in that project with you. They wanted to get involved. What was Zerubbabel's answer? His answer was no. He refused the proffered help of the Samaritans. He did not want them involved in the construction work. Why? For two reasons. First, if you look, and this was Zerubbabel's answer to the Samaritans, he said, if you look at the decree of King Cyrus, we don't want to disobey that decree. That decree was to permit Israelites to return from Babylon to work on the construction work, not someone else. So we don't want to disobey that decree that came from Cyrus. The other thing, and I think probably more importantly in Zerubbabel's mind, was the fact that if he would have permitted the Samaritans to have become involved in the construction work, he would have felt some obligation, some at least a moral obligation, to have permitted them to have some influence in the type of worship that would have been permitted and organized in the temple itself. And of course, these Samaritans, some of them were idol worshipers. And of course, we've gotten through talking about Israel had such a struggle with idol worship. I think Zerubbabel was very careful at this point. He didn't want to go back to what the Israelites had just paid a major price for. So he was very careful not to want to permit any idol worshipers to have any influence in the temple worship. He wanted to make sure that the temple worship stayed clean. Well, you can imagine what the reaction of the Samaritans was. It was one of disappointment. In fact, it was stronger than disappointment. They were angry. In fact, they were outraged at this refusal. Imagine, you know, we're offering you something and you're turning us down. Well, they didn't take very kindly. And they showed their displeasure by doing so many things against the Israelites that were in opposition to the construction project. They wanted to stop the work. If we can't be part of it, then you're not going to finish the project, was the attitude of the Samaritans. They had, of course, tried many tactics, including violence, threats. They tried lawsuits, political pressure. They told lies. Whatever they had to do, whatever they could do to throw sand in the gears, as it were, is what they did. Now, this resistance, again, was not new But because it's been going on ever since they got over there, the resistance from the Samaritans. But after the foundations were laid, and after they achieved this major milestone, the builders got tired fighting. Again, it was a constant battle. And perhaps there may have been even an escalation by the Samaritans of their opposition once the temple foundation was laid. There was a second source of external adversity that caused the builders to cease doing the construction work, to lose their zeal. Now remember, when Zerubbabel returned from Babylon and returned with the contingent of 50,000 workers back to Jerusalem, at that point in time, it was under the very friendly King Cyrus. King Cyrus was succeeded by his not-so-friendly son. His name was Cambyses, King Cambyses. King Cambyses was a conqueror. King Cambyses was a warrior. King Cambyses was an expansionist. King Cambyses was interested in expanding the amount of territory under his control. And one of the places where he had his eye on was Egypt. There's a hint to one of the three ribs in the bear's teeth. Eventually, King Cambyses did conquer Egypt. It came under his control. But in the process of doing this conquering work, his army, which was not very disciplined, regularly passed through the area where the Israelites were doing the rebuilding. And on a regular basis, as they were going back and forth, Cambyses' army between Egypt, as they passed through the area, they regularly looted the place. And of course, this was a great discouragement to the Israelites. Here they are, they're trying to build something. And routinely, time after time, these undisciplined hordes of soldiers walk through, they come through, they march through, and they loot the place. It was very discouraging to them. So those were the two sources of external resistance, the Samaritans and the hordes of soldiers from that were associated with King Cambyses and his expansionist activities. Certainly that hostility helped and that rough treatment helped to break Israel's spirit. But we think that the main reason that the construction workers lost their zeal was not external, but it was internal. The temple builders became lukewarm regarding spiritual matters. And that was bad enough, to become lukewarm towards spiritual matters. But what was worse is they became hot relative to their temporal matters. They had two things going on. The spirituality was going down, and the temporality was going up. Less emphasis on one, more emphasis on the other. The builders turned away from doing the Lord's work, and they began working for themselves. Now, we recall, as we mentioned earlier, that these housing units, the living infrastructure that they built when they returned, they were pretty plain. Nothing fancy, No designer walls or no designer wallpaper and things like that. It was just basic living quarters. Well, some of the construction workers, after they had lost their zeal, again, they had entered into these contracts with the merchants of Tyre and Sidon to obtain cedar wood. They decided they would take some of the cedar wood, wood that was dedicated for use in the construction of the temple reconstruction project, and they were going to take it and use it in their own homes. And we find reference to that in Haggai, and particularly in verse 4, chapter 1. Cedar paneling, we might note, was normally associated with the palaces of royalty. So here these folks started to think about themselves as royalty. Probably wasn't a good idea. The Israelites' lukewarm spirit condition, they're drifting from the Lord and they're more focusing on themselves and walking away from the Lord, led to something else. As we read down through chapter 1, it led to drought. It led to inflation. It led to famine, severe weather, low crop yields. There were consequences to their lukewarm condition that they had developed. You know, many years prior to Haggai, the Lord through Moses told the Israelites, "If you serve me faithfully and you fulfill your covenant, you will have prosperity. But if you neglect me and you neglect your covenant that you've entered into with me, you are going to experience at least relative temporal privation." This is beautifully set out for us in Deuteronomy, the 28th chapter. Most of that chapter is dedicated to this idea of obey and be blessed, and disobey, and you're going to lose out. So this is the condition of things that Haggai faced when he returned. Approximately 50,000 Israelites that were lukewarm. 50,000 Israelites were neglecting the spiritual matters in favor of unnecessary temporal matters. And we underscore the word unnecessary. And this sad condition had been in existence for approximately 10 years. It was approximately 10 years that the construction work ceased from about 530 to 520. Well, this is the situation Haggai was sent to try to help with. The anemic spiritual condition of these Israelites. So Haggai's job was to rekindle their spirit, to get them back to work, to rekindle their zeal, their courage, their fortitude, their faith, their desires to get back and do the Lord's work. So what did Haggai do? Friends, picture it. If you were sent to face and to address a crowd of some 50,000 lukewarm individuals, what would you say to them if your job was to rekindle their zeal and their spirit and so on? What would you say to turn things around? Well, Haggai went to the leadership. He went to Zerubbabel, their civil leader, and he went to Joshua, their religious leader, their high priest. And he worked with and through these two men. And, of course, his message, obviously, was also addressed to the construction workers themselves. As we read through the book of Haggai, we find that Haggai issued forth not one message, not two, but five. And we'll try very quickly to touch on each of these five messages. We'd like to paraphrase the first message. The first message we find extending from verses 4 through verse 11. Verses 4 through 11. And we might paraphrase this message something like the following. You and your workers, Zerubbabel and Joshua, suggest that it's not time to finish the work of building the Lord's house. You've said you've got other things to do. And then when you get those things done, then you'll get back to the Lord's work. This is what you have said. But I ask you a rhetorical question. I ask you a very searching question. Is it right? Is it right for you to live in your beautiful houses while the Lord's house lay in relative ruins? Is that right? Think about what you've been doing over the past 10 years. When during this past 10 years, you have served mostly yourselves. Think about how you have fared. Search your own hearts. You have sown much seed, and you have reaped relatively little. And what you have harvested has been low quality. It's been very unsatisfying. You've earned wages during the past 10 years. But you've also experienced inflation, and economic failure have left you in relative economic poverty. You know, the Lord told you to use your resources to build the Lord's house. That was what His instructions were to you, and thereby aim to please Him. You had great expectations from your labors, but the Lord brought them to naught because of how you were using your energy and your time. You are neglecting the Lord's work in favor of engaging in your own unnecessary temporal activities. It's no secret, you are the direct cause of your own plight. Because you have withdrawn from God, He has withdrawn from you. Think about it. That's this first message. It was a message of reproof. We'd like to characterize each of these messages with one word. This message we might call the message of realization. It was a wake-up call. And it was not a gentle message. It was not a gentle nudge in the ribs. It was a strong reproof, asking them, suggesting them to them that they search their own hearts. So Haggai sharply reproved the Israelites because that's what they needed, to wake up to a realization of what had happened to them over the last 10 years. What was the response? Well, Zerubbabel and Joshua responded. And they responded quickly. Within 3 weeks, this massive workforce was back on the job. They had turned back to the Lord. What did the Lord do once these folks turned back to Him? What did Haggai then respond with? Haggai responded with a second message. And the second message we find recorded for us in verses 13 through 15. Actually, it's just in verse 13 is the message. Verses 12 and 14 and 15 are a little bit of background and context. What was this second message? Was it more reproof? Was it more hard-hitting? No. They had responded to the first message by turning their attitudes and their hearts back to God. So this, the second message was in response to this turn back to faithfulness. So this message, the second message, was not a further reproof. No, no. This message was now a message of encouragement. And we find this message very briefly stated in verse 13, the last part. The second message is one sentence. I am with you, saith the Lord. Almost as short as Jonah's prophecy. But that was his second message. Not reproof, but encouragement. God promptly rewarded the people's positive change of attitude. As soon as they changed their attitude, He was there to encourage them, to give them encouragement along the way, to rekindle them in the right direction. And because they had responded by going from walking in their own way to returning and developing, rekindling a reverent attitude toward God, He responded with this second message. So Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the workers responded. They responded by getting back on the job and getting back to work. So that's the first two messages. They get back to work. What happens next? We find a third message. The Lord again responded about 4 weeks later. And He sent Haggai to issue a third message to these reorganized workers. We find this in chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. And we might paraphrase this lesson, this particular message, as follows. Look around you, Zerubbabel, Joshua, and all you faithful temple builders. And how does this temple look, the one that you're working on now? How does it compare to Solomon's temple that stood on this site some 85 years ago? Now, I realize some of you weren't here. Some of you may remember. You may be old enough. Some of you have only heard of it by reputation. But how does this temple look in comparison to Solomon's temple that was here before? Well, you folks are probably saying that, gee, it's not much of a comparison. You're probably saying, how can we ever possibly regain that level of magnificence in this temple structure that once existed in Solomon's magnificent temple? How can we ever get back to that? And the Lord speaks to them and He says, I, the Lord, will tell you how. I made a covenant with you in Sinai, and that covenant is still in force. I guaranteed you under my covenant that I made with you, I guaranteed you my strength, my spirit, my help, if you obeyed me. That's how this temple is going to be finished. It's not going to be finished in your strength, in your might. No, no. Your victory is going to come through your faith in me. And so we call this third message, friends, it was a message of faith. It was rekindling their faith, their trust, their confidence, their reliance upon Him. The reliance that they knew they had and perhaps had just forgotten because of their covenant relationship that still existed between them and God. Again, the workers responded. They pressed on. And again, the Lord sent them another message. This time, message number 4. We find this in verses 10 through 19 of chapter 2. This message, very simple. Don't forget. Don't forget how you experienced adversity in your not-so-recent past. Don't forget. Remember. Don't engage in unholy conduct. Don't do that, because remember what happened. It alienated both of us from each other. And it led to less than pleasant results and experiences for you. So remember your past experiences. So we suggested the fourth message is a reminder message. That led, of course, to a fifth message. And the fifth message we find in chapter 2, verses 20 through the end of the book. This message pertained to the future, would be the overthrow of all the kingdoms of the world, all of the enemies of Israel, as it were, and the establishment of the true Zerubbabel, the higher Zerubbabel, as the leader. So here we have it, friends. We have five messages that Haggai delivered. Realization, encouragement, faith, a reminder, and hope. Five messages. We know the messages worked, because the temple was finished in just 4 years after Haggai delivered his first message. By the way, Haggai's five messages took only about 4 months to give. So again, this is a relatively short span from beginning to end of this particular prophecy. Our second question, or our next question we should say, is how do we apply these lessons to ourselves? Do these messages apply to the gospel age in our day? We think that they do, very clearly. Remember what Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 17. He says that ye are the temple of God. So we can see the association between spiritual Israel and natural Israel. Zerubbabel's materialistic temple is symbolic of the true temple, the spiritual temple, the temple of God, the body of Christ. Now we think we can apply this prophecy of Haggai on two different levels. The first level on which we can apply this to the gospel age, to the true Israelites, the spiritual Israelites, is on a corporate level, or on a dispensational level, to the church as a whole, is what we're saying. And particularly, as we go back to Haggai, we'll look at chapter 2, verse 9, when Haggai talks about the greater temple than Solomon's temple. He runs a comparison between the spiritual temple there, the Solomon's temple, and the true spiritual temple, the temple of God. The foundation of the true temple was laid in the days of Jesus and the apostles, wasn't it? There was much enthusiasm, but the apostles fell asleep. There was a great falling away. The apostasy developed. The dark ages came into play. So for 1,000 years or so, the work on the spiritual temple was largely stopped. Maybe not completely, but in large measure. And of course, a drought followed, just like with natural Israel. A drought of spiritual food and water. But beginning in the 1500s, beginning with Luther, and continuing on up through Calvin and Knox and Wesley and Campbell and Miller and Russell, there was a reawakening, and is a reawakening. These ones brought the vessels back to the temple, the divine truths, and they restarted, they kick-started again, as it were, the building work, the major part of the building work, to get this temple completed at this point in time. So that's the corporate level, just a very quick overview of the corporate level. But we also think that we can apply this prophecy of Haggai on a personal level, on a you level, or on a me level. What's the great danger facing us today? perhaps the greatest danger? Well, we learn of this in Revelation, the third chapter. What was the great danger for the Laodicean church? It was lukewarmness, the exact same thing as what the construction workers experienced. Being overcharged with the cares of this life. In the last days, perilous times shall come. Maybe not so much from the outward enemies, although that's certainly, we believe that that is there for us to deal with, but perhaps the greatest enemy is the enemy within, our own selves. Indifference, worldly spirit, materialism, fleshly gratification, great company fears, all of these things are the enemies. All of these things are our spiritual Samaritans at this point in our lives. There are constant enemies. And our message to each other on an individual level is don't shrink back from these things. Don't shrink back from battling these enemies, from putting the armor on and pressing forward. Remember, we can't win this battle by ourselves. I know all of us already know that. We need our Zerubbabel. We need our Joshua to lead us, to give us the strength, to give us the motivation, the incentive, the encouragement. And so, friends, we believe that on this personal level, what we should be listening for is we should be listening for these same five messages. We should be listening at times for messages of reproof. We should have our ears open for messages of encouragement, of building more reliance or trust or faith upon the Lord. Open for messages from Him as a reminder that we can fall away. And also encouragement about our future prospect, that hope, that message of hope, that incentive, the thing that we're working for to bless all the families of the earth as a result of the completed temple. Friends, as the Israelites did back then, we need to keep our swords at our sides as we are doing our construction work, because only by faith can we gain the victory. We complete our lesson now with the words of Haggai chapter 2, verse 4, which we think is a beautiful summary of the encouragement that we can receive. Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Joseph, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts.
Thank you, Brother Wes. And especially at the end there, stands out in my mind about the different messages, and the first message of realization or reproof. And we just pray for ourselves, and sometimes we get stuck on that message ourselves, and trying to get over that and move on to the rest for our own selves personally. We have some more love that we wanted to share from Brethren Online, and from there's one that came in actually from Brother Roman Kuzma from another, I'm not sure actually who conveyed that love originally, but then from online we also have Brother Jerry and Sister Sharon Leslie sending their love. They also convey the love of Sister Julia, but that did come in yesterday from Tulum, Siberia. And then also love from the Hagen Six and Jeff and Estera. Mezra, and North Seattle Bible students, and Brother David and Carol and Sister Kristen Kirkham, Brother Robert and Sister Debbie Wiggins, Brother Peter Knapp and his wife, Sister Lisa, Brenna and their new baby, Allison, Bill and Donna Ostrander, and also just a few more quick words here again. Thank you. There's already been a lot of brethren going and finding the cards outside there. We appreciate that. And we really, yesterday with the short breaks and all, and this being in a bad spot, it was an impossible situation. So hopefully with the longer breaks and the better location, there will be a better sporting chance to get to it with everything else going on. We also have a reminder to check out for those in the hotel, 1 p.m., 1 p.m., and then also remember that the lunch is not the big epic journey to the pool. It's right next door, right outside here in room C. And so we're going to close with those last two hymns that we left on hymn 102, and we'll be having a closing prayer from Brother Wes. One last comment. For those that haven't registered for meals, if there's a few of you, there's bound to be a few, go see Sister Debbie. We have like 10 spots open. So go see Sister Debbie and let's see if we can use those seats and not let that food go to waste. Thank you.
Eternal God and loving Father, Thou who art from everlasting unto everlasting, the giver of every good and perfect and wonderful gift, hallowed be Thy most blessed and holy name. We thank Thee, Father, for the lessons of this day. We thank Thee for how we see something of the heights and the depths and the breadths of Thy marvelous plan of the ages. We thank Thee, Father, particularly now for the lesson of the prophet Haggai. We thank Thee for the lessons of the past, and we see their outworking upon natural Israel. We also appreciate, Father, being able to see the application to spiritual Israel. Help us to take heart these precious 5 messages that Thou hast given us through the words of that prophet. Help us to continually, Father, be ever open, our eyes to be open, our ears to be open, and to Thy cry, to whatever the message that Thou would have for us, and help us to promptly respond. That these messages might be further enthroned in our hearts, so we might press on with greater zeal and determination and faithfulness and do our part as construction workers in the completion of this grand and glorious temple that Thou hast designed. We do seek, Father, Thy forgiveness for our sins and shortcomings and for anything thought or said or done that was displeasing or out of harmony, and ask that it be overruled to Thy name's glory and to our growth in Christ. We thank Thee now for the fellowship time that follows. We ask Thee, Father, to help us to continue to reset and refocus our attention upon those things which are above in our fellowship one with another. We also thank Thee for the temporal nourishment. May we use the energy derived from it as well to serve Thee in spirit and in truth the balance of this convention upon which we ask Thy blessing. And it's through Christ that we pray. Amen.
Thank you, brethren.